Greetings, Clinically Thinking listeners. It is so good to speak with you once again. It's been too long. Today, I am very excited to have as my guest, Professor Lorimer Moseley. As you will know, we usually have clinical psychologists on this podcast, but on this occasion, I have made an exception. The reason I invited Professor Moseley to speak to us is because I think that in our experience, psychologists have people come into their offices to seek treatment for other things, and often as we go along, find that pain is part of the picture. And I suspect that aside from a very few, most of us don't know a lot about pain and don't have a lot of education in pain biology or pain physiology or any of the matters that are relevant to pain. And so therefore, it seemed like a good opportunity to have some update, a little taster, if you like, around the modern thinking around pain. Professor Lorimer Moseley is a Bradley Distinguished Professor at the University of South Australia. He is a clinical and research physiotherapist, Professor of Clinical Neurosciences, Foundation Chair in Physiotherapy, and CEO of the nonprofit Pain Revolution. He's authored 400 scientific articles and 7 books. He has made seminal contributions in both pain science and pain management and won prizes from governments or professional societies in 13 countries. He has delivered 3 public pain events to over 30,000 people in 6 countries, and his public-facing videos attract over 5 million views annually. In 2020, he was made an Officer of the Order of Australia, Australia's second highest civilian honour, for distinguished service to the fields of pain and its management, education, science, communication, and physiotherapy to humanity at large. Thank you so much, Lorimer, for giving us some of your time, sharing with us some time. I'm very excited. I am having a slight fangirl moment. As it happens, I saw my osteo this morning and I said what I was doing today, and he was doing a fanboy moment. He was pretty excited with that.
Oh, that's so cool.
It's very cool. And I said, what questions have you got for him? So he couldn't think of any questions because he was kind of paralyzed with excitement.
is this the intro you give to everyone? It's very flattering.
So tell me, why pain? Why pain for you as an area of interest? How did you get there?
It's a lovely question, Lisa, and I think my answer to that question has changed over the years of becoming more aware of myself and stuff like that. I think, lots of reasons. I think clinically, when I was working as a physiotherapist, the people with chronic pain were clearly, in my experience, the most outcast, on the edges, disadvantaged, misunderstood, unfairly treated and talked about. And I reckon I just grew up in a home where you stand up for those people, and that's your obligation. So I think there was a bit of that. I've always been fascinated by humans ever since I can remember being alive. I've thought, wow, we are pretty fascinating. Amazing. I find myself particularly fascinating. but as a rule, humans. And then lived experience of having pain. I was a pretty serious footballer and experienced injuries that took years and years to stop hurting. And pain's really a horrible thing to have every day. It really is. And no one else can see it. And people walk around, they don't have their crutches, and they put on a brave face, and it can be pretty lonely, and then we haven't been helping them. So I guess those 3 things came together in a perfect storm, and I fell into a PhD and became a researcher, and it's a great job. It aligns with my values, and, I'm an explorer. I get to explore. Anyway, it's fantastic.
All right, let's crack in. I guess I first became aware of your work with Explain Pain, of course, but more recently I saw the TEDx talk, the stick thing. So that introduced me to that fabulous story. You had a bit more hair there, I have to say, but that was a great introduction. But why is chronic pain such a bugger to treat?
That's a cracking first question. Well, I think because it's so complex, right? It's just it's in my view, it's probably as individual in its underlying contributors as humans are, and that means that, you know, there's very few things that work for everyone, and I guess. I get off on the complexity of the organism as a thing, I have this phrase, we are fearfully and wonderfully complex, that really resonates deeply within me. Yeah. But then the person in chronic pain is a complex human within a complex world and within a complex health care system that is not really set up in any way to think, operate or evaluate in ways that are helpful for chronic pain as a rule, you know, like the systems we've got, the ways of thinking we've got don't really accommodate what we now understand to be how chronic pain works, and the best treatments we have are really about enabling and empowering people in pain to negotiate what is a really challenging recovery journey a lot of the time. It takes a lot of work, you know. So there's so many answers to that question, I guess.
And we'll probably unpack them as we go along to a certain extent. But can you give me a simple explanation for something I'd understand? And I think our listeners will be interested in and the differences between acute and chronic pain.
I guess the way that, well, there's so many answers to that question, actually, but my answer to that question would be, so acute pain is normally providing an excellent protective function. And my view is that pain is always protective. It protects us and it provides healing. And acute pain, I mean, it's been honed, in my view, over countless generations through evolution to be a system that gives us the right amount of protection while the injured or inflamed tissue backs off again and heals and remodels and all that. So pain is the thing that the ups the protective buffer. And chronic pain, people sometimes define chronic pain by how long it's been around or by its relationship to the perceived tissue healing rates of the triggering injury. I guess one way to think about chronic pain is it becomes a problem when pain is overprotecting you. So you're feeling that you have in your body is overstating the fragility or the vulnerability of that body part. And then it becomes a problem. And I think it's a nice way of differentiating acute and chronic pain from a pragmatic, you know, what should we do about these things clinically sort of perspective. But that's controversial. You know, there are some people who say acute pain is pain for less than 3 months. Chronic is more than 3 months, which means 2 months and 30 days for the average month. You've got acute pain and you wake up the next morning with chronic pain. So that's got a real problem with it as a definition.
So we need to think more broadly about the definition of what makes acute and what makes chronic, because it really makes a difference where it's spread, doesn't it?
If we shifted the question to not have to categorize in that way, if we could just categorize pain as whether it is giving an optimal protective buffer or not, there are situations when you have an acute injury that might be brutally painful in a way that's it's going way overboard on the protection that it's offering you. So an example might be someone who's got a tiny tweak of a tissue in their low back, and backs are notorious, right? They're really well stocked with danger detectors, and it means all this stuff. Back injury means a whole lot that's different from ankle injury, for example. So there's all these reasons that protection is always going to be higher if the incident is happening maybe around your head or your spinal cord, you know, your back or your neck or something like that. But there are situations when you have a tiny tweak or maybe not even an identifiable minor injury, it's so small, but the pain is absolutely terrifying and brutal. And I think at times like that, there are now studies going on around several places in the world in accident and emergency departments to look at what else is contributing to this person's pain, what else is making this pain so bad because it's overly protective. They need a bit of pain because they have to give the tissues a chance to heal, but they don't need the extent of pain that they're having. So I think that might be an easier way to think about it, because then we don't have to have this dichotomized understanding of acute pain. You know, a lot of people say good pain, helpful pain, and then all of a sudden it becomes unhelpful. But I think about it more as pain is always multifactorial, no matter when you have it. We do experiments with people where we don't do anything at all to the tissues of their body, and we can make that. We can give them pain through that. So whether or not pain is chronic or acute, I think I would rather think about it as is this pain helpful? Is it protective and promoting healing? Or is it now overprotective and preventing recovery?
I guess I'm thinking in terms of the average psychologist or clinical psych in the office who has a referral for sometimes for pain treatment of chronic pain, because we don't often, you know, private practice get referrals for acute pain. They go, they're the hospital. Health psychologists sometimes will in a hospital setting, but mostly not. Is there a thing called episodic pain? Like people have, you know, arthritis and so forth that comes and goes, pain comes and goes a bit. I don't know what these labels should be, but I certainly see some people who have pain. I think, oh, you've got a degenerative thing going on there. Maybe you will have pain from time to time, and maybe that's just to be expected, and it's doing its thing, protecting you from further damage. Is there another third term or that's equally unhelpful?
I mean, the boffins in committee rooms in the World Peak Body on Pain define things like this, but I guess that would be recurrent pain. We would say recurrent. But those official people are moving towards a categorization system that talks about nociceptive pain, which is a bit more like what we used to think acute pain was. But nociceptive pain is, I don't know the exact definitions, but it's pain that is associated with activation of the danger detectors in your tissues, which are called nociceptors. So if the tissue is broken, it will be inflamed, and then the danger detectors are highly sensitive. It's one of the coolest things I know about in biology is how quickly your danger detectors totally transform the way they work so that you can't put any threat anywhere near it. Yeah. And that's nociceptive pain, so pain associated with injury or inflammation. Then they talk about neuropathic pain, which is pain associated with damage or disease, demonstrable disease of nervous system structures. So you might have a peripheral nerve injury, like you might have cut a nerve when you know, you had a bullet wound or something like that, or you might have multiple sclerosis or a stroke, which damages the central nervous system. And then the third category, which is pretty controversial at the moment, it's only been around for a few years, is called nociplastic pain.
Tell us about that.
Oh, it's highly problematic as a word, in my view. I'm not official, right? I'm an unofficial commentator on it.
Okay.
And very clever and excellent people have put a lot of time into coming up with this term. But what nociplastic pain officially means is pain associated with activity in neurons in response to stimuli that don't exist. So hopefully you hear that and think, what? That makes no sense to me at all. So we've spent a lot of time asking consumers and health professionals, what should we call this type of situation? Okay. And they tell us, call it pain system hypersensitivity. So I would now say that no. it's not very catchy, no. No, but it's blame consumers because they came up with it, right? So they said, call it pain system hypersensitivity because it captures, I think, what nociplastic pain is meant to be about, and that is that you have pain when you're not, your tissues are not actually in danger.
And is that don't need chronic pain then? Is that, that's...
Most chronic pain, I would say, all chronic pain is associated with some degree of pain system hypersensitivity.
Yeah, right.
And the challenge, I guess, for the psychologist, the clinical psychologist or other psychologist, when working with someone with chronic pain, the utility of that is that they can think, okay, so this person's pain system will be overprotecting their body.
Yeah.
But resist the temptation. And this is so hard for all healthcare professionals, and we've got evidence to suggest it might be harder for psychologists than for biomedically, you know, like physios and doctors.
Tell me, I want to hear about that.
Yeah, so it's really surprising. It's quite old data. It may not still be the case, but the first step feels easy to say, okay, this person's pain system is being overprotective.
Yeah.
But the hard bit that goes with that is to not conclude that it's an immutable situation, or like it's unchangeable, or this person is somehow doing something, expressing things differently or reporting. What we now know is what people, like all these factors, many of them in the psychological realm, make pain worse. The common thing that we get from psychologically trained people is a real resistance to that idea, whereas they tend to be more likely to hang on to the idea that pain is a neural transmitted signal somewhere.
Yes.
There's a message somewhere in the nervous system that says pain or something like that. And there's not. Mm. There's no such thing as pain outside of consciousness. So you can't to say that, oh, this person has moderate pain, but they feel it as excessive pain. That makes no sense, because pain is only something you feel. It doesn't exist anywhere else. So the challenge is to embrace the true complexity of the system, the output of which is pain. And it infiltrates all of our clinical language and interactions and facial expressions when we're dealing with people. Yeah, it's tough.
Excellent. I got lots of questions around that. So, okay, that's the case. How do we re-educate this pain system? And you've got your perspective, and around physios and so forth, and then some data about psychologists, and I'd like to hear about both.
I can start with the second one because it's old data, but it was really interesting data. And it's around educating people, giving people an understanding of how pain works that matches our current scientific understanding. So to make sense of that, I'd probably just want to differentiate those things. So in the olden days, if we say from the 17th century on, but then we'll get to the 90s really quickly. So from the really olden days, René Descartes came up with this idea that, among other things, but the idea that pain is detected and a message is sent along pain pathways to pain centers and you experience pain. Yeah. And that's still a pretty dominant view among the general public and among most healthcare professionals.
Mm-hmm.
The psychologists, to their credit, in the 80s or so, 1980s and into the 90s, started to really embrace the idea that, well, with chronic pain, pain and the impact on your life are two different things. So you can have pain but still have a meaningful life, engage with meaningful activities. My view is that position was influenced in part by discoveries that the nervous system changed when pain persists. So the response, the way that neurons respond to each other changes. In my view, it's learning within the system. And the psychologists really thought, well, this is about pain management now. We've got to accept that pain is unchangeable and we need to help people manage it. So how to live well despite pain, how to employ strategies that give you a good life.
I remember this in the 90s. This is the Melzac thing, isn't it, around that era in the early 90s, living well with pain.
Yeah, yeah. So, and that's still a big deal. And I would say I reckon it's still the dominant view among CBT-informed pain workers. It would be great to have on your show a guy called Michael Nicholas from Sydney. He was one of my PhD supervisors. He developed world-leading pain management programs. And, yeah, I've got deep respect and gratitude for Michael Nicholas. I would say that he would still say that the main deal here is helping people to manage well manage their life well, even though they will have pain forever. He may disagree with that. And whenever I talk to him, he sort of disagrees on the spot, but then I bust him in another conversation or at a conference talk. And I feel like sticking my hand up and saying, Michael,
you again, grandstanding.
Oh, bloody hell, Lorimer, he's man.
Difficult question, just to annoy me, cause me to sweat.
So, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I do think that most pain psychologists will still be in this mindset, that's implicating language, will be in a mindset where the objective is to help people live well despite pain and accept that their pain is now a part of them because of changes in their brain and spinal cord. My view is different from that. And this started happening around the late 90s. The research became clearer and clearer that pain is this dynamic thing that's highly changeable, actually, and actually changes a lot moment to moment. So if you were, if you had a sore neck right now before this conversation started and our conversation was interesting enough, you would have no neck pain at all. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Until I said, how's your neck? And then you'd have neck pain. And as we started to think more about that, I guess people started to accept that it's biologically reasonable that you don't have any neck pain when you don't have neck pain. And that sounds a bit stupid, but the way that we used to interpret it is that, during the conversation, you didn't notice your neck pain, but it was still there in some way. And we don't think that now. We think, okay, the brain stopped making pain during that other event. So anyway, so the psychologist thing, all that to get to the point where we started 25 years ago, we started teaching patients, consumers and the general public some really different ways to think about the biology of pain. And that's where Explain Pain came out of that work. So Explain Pain was written on the basis of the research that looked at what happens when you give people an understanding of how pain really works. And then we noticed their pain got a bit better, their disability got better, all these other things changed. And then we did a big survey of healthcare professionals who had participated in some of these seminars. And at the end of it, we said, if your typical patient participated in a seminar like this, how well do you think they would learn the information? And all the healthcare professionals sat very, very similarly in sort of, I guess, their perceived capacity of patients to understand this was, moderate, except for one group, the psychologist, two standard deviations away, said, no, they won't get it. They won't understand it. So that leaves the possibility that psychologists see patients who are more stupid than the patients who see everyone else. Or the psychologists are misrepresenting their patients. They have an understanding of their patients that maybe that's right and everyone else is wrong, but our data clearly show that all healthcare professionals underestimate the capacity of patients to understand. All of us do that. And back in 2003, psychologists were the worst offenders and the only ones who are different from everyone.
Maybe it's because, when they come to psychologists, they're only there half of the time when it comes to pain, because everyone also said, we can't help you, you need to go and see the psychologist. And they get this idea that it's in their head. And so they come with an attitude of, I better do this, but I don't believe it. The psychologist can't help me. I need to see the physio. I need to see the doctor who's going to give you the endone. I don't need to see the psychologist bullshit. This is all on, this is not in my head.
Yeah.
So yeah. You've done some totally. Research on this?
Well, so much research on that. So that's definitely a thing for sure, I think. Most of our research, everyone who turns up at those sorts of things would say exactly like you have, but not say when they come to see a psychologist. They would say when they come to see me, they've seen everyone else. And they're convinced that no one's listening no one wants to say it's all in my head. But the question in that survey was not about how well will they enact it or will they believe you. It was, do you think they can understand it? And back then, we all underestimated patients by a long way.
So if we underestimate them, well, I'm thinking about patients of mine who have, mental health issues as well as then pain that's become chronic, and trying to get them to understand the sorts of concepts you're talking about as being very difficult. And maybe that says something about my lack of skill than anything else. So I don't know, because I'm one of those people.
Probably not. Yeah, yeah. But well, so we all were in that survey, right? So it's not, you're not
psychologist.
I think that, I imagine that in that survey, the people who were seen by psychologists would probably have found it more difficult to understand just by the things you're talking about.
Yeah.
But I can't accept they would have found it two standard deviations. I don't know that that's still the case.
I feel like there's that the clients I've had most success with, and my listeners may be listening to this and thinking, oh, well, you just don't know, you just don't see enough clients, you don't have enough skill. But nevertheless, my experience of 30 years working in clinical psychology with the occasional pain client would be that the ones I've had success with are the ones actually who just have pain but who don't have a work cover injury a lot of personal problems or a lot of complex mental health issues as well. They've just come with, I've got arthritis, I've got too much medication, I need some help to manage the pain, so we'll work through some pacing and yoo-haw, success. Pain medication comes down, capacity to manage life goes up, see you later, four sessions later. So that's, I don't know, what do you make of that?
No, that's great. Well, I think most of us would feel the same way, that as soon as, if there's a compensation claim on the go, the brain now has a new set of data and a new range of potential outcomes that it must consider when it's creating feelings for us to guide our behavior. So I think that workers' comp makes it more challenging as a rule. We know that engaging a solicitor often makes the chance of recovery a bit less. Comorbidities, all that sort of stuff for sure. But to speak to the sentiment of that observation, you said, you said something like, maybe I don't have the skills to give people the understanding.
I put that out there.
We've got real world data from hundreds of patients, 1,500 almost consecutive patients who have seen a range of healthcare professionals, physios, exercise physiologists, psychologists, general practitioners, OTs, and for those data, we've trained the clinicians really well, right? So I would say they're really good pain educators and clinicians.
Okay. Yeah.
And when we look at their data, they're getting the learning objectives so that their patients are understanding the key learning objectives about half the time.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right, so the experts are getting about 50% hit rate.
Well, I feel much better now.
Yeah, you should. I mean, anyone out there listening, most people would say, well, I get one in four.
That's
fair enough. All right. But
there's a long way to go.
You train me up. But
that's
what we're trying. But when we train you up, you get 50% here, right? Right. Which is why we've spent so much time in the last sort of 6 or 7 years chasing the objective of can we get better learning attainment through whatever mechanisms we can get, And if we can, what are the most important things to learn? So we've got a lot of consumer, recovered consumer input, a lot of stuff from learning frameworks, educational psychology, all this sort of stuff.
So we'll get some of that up. We'll get some of that up on the podcast Facebook page, if you're okay with that, so that we can share it with our listeners. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. So we've written a couple of papers about sort of delivery strategies and ways of thinking, and the tools. The most exciting development, I reckon, is the introduction of embodied learning, so active learning experiences to target specific concepts. So we do that with virtual reality, and we haven't done a clinical trial or anything on outcomes, but we're getting 85% achievement of learning objectives.
That sounds
and the
great.
Reason that that, yeah, and that's so important because our real world data show that in this broad group of people with chronic pain, if we can change the way they understand the problem, they're highly likely to recover. Like, it's amazing.
Absolutely. Buy-in seems to me to be everything. It seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, because I want to learn. I'm sure our listeners want to learn. But if there's no buy-in to these notions about pain, then there is, you might as well hit your head on a wall over and over again, because the client will just, no, will not participate. I want my endone. And you say, no, that's not going to work. It's going to make you worse. No, that whole notion of getting that buy-in and understanding and really believing it, or at least trusting or having some hope. And I'm just reading this book. I read this book. You know this one?
For my listeners,
Why Does It Still Hurt? And you, if I may, in here he calls explain pain canonical. Just FYI.
Well,
high really praise. Go. Yeah, it's nice,
isn't it? High praise, isn't it? He knows what he's talking about too, I might add.
And now I've completely lost my train of thought. What was I talking about?
Well, that unless we get that shift in understanding,
that's right,
we're going to get this thing. And if your listeners could see me now, I'd have my arms crossed. And
yes. We
call that the fuck off posture.
Yes.
You know, you start saying, I mean, you see the arms go up. I mean, you guys are experts on that. I'm not. But I totally agree. And the more I learn about this stuff, the more I think if we can get better at shifting just a general understanding of how pain works and why it makes sense that that you see a psychologist. I mean, a lot of the people who get referred to a psychologist don't go because they think,
I can understand that, because I say, why would they go? They won't tell the doctor that. But what I was referring to in this book was somewhere it talks about hope. And I sometimes refer to myself when I'm working with some of these clients who's maybe I can be the keeper of hope. Just give me half a dozen sessions with you to work on this. Suspend your disbelief that, or your belief that this is rubbish and a waste of time, and do the things I've asked you to do. Take it on board for a bit. And then if it hasn't worked in half a dozen sessions, then you can say, she was a quack, I'm going back to my doctor for some more endone. We do this in other areas. So, I'm wondering about whether that might be a way to go. But, you know, I don't know. What do you think?
Do you feel like it works? Do you feel like, do you get some wins when you do that?
I do.
Yeah.
I do feel a little bit narcissistic in the sense of, you know, am I the great messiah? And I don't want to feel that way. But I do feel a little bit like you just have to suspend your hypothesis A, that this is a waste of time, and in order to bother coming, and go with my hypothesis that I might actually know something that can help you for a bit. Mm-hmm. We do this, in, for example, in body dysmorphia, when clients are often also resistant to coming to session because of that. Why would I want to go and see, you know, the psychologist? Oh, not body dysmorphia, sorry, health anxiety. And the doctors send them along, the psychiatrists send them along because they don't have anything they can find. And so they come with their arms crossed, fuck you, why am I here?
Yeah.
And so we have this idea of, well, either the doctors have missed something and you're right, or this is anxiety. So you're here. Do you want to explore this for a bit and see? Give me half a dozen, maybe 10 sessions. And if in that time you make no progress, then I'll discharge you. You can go back and see Dr. X, and good luck with that. Trouble is getting it to say past two or three sessions is hard. And I'm sure there are people out there that are better at this work than I am, but generally that's the way we approach it. So.
And do you ever strategize trying to engineer a kernel of hope of their own? Like, so what I'm thinking of there is some of the things that a physio could do and you guys probably have similar things at your disposal, I'm sure. But what a physio could do would be to give them a very simple exercise or posture or stretch or something and ask them to observe whether it changes their pain, knowing full well that it will slightly improve their pain because of the neurophysiology of the event.
Absolutely.
And then that gives them a little, oh,
yeah,
something's changing.
Something that, a little win, something that can't possibly fail. Absolutely. And then that absolutely increases buy-in because they've had a success. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we do have versions of that. And one of the important contributors to that is around language, if I may just talk about words. Because it seems to me, and as a psychologist, this could be so obvious, but for pain patients, and I've lived this experience with physios and osteos and so forth, what we say matters around pain, doesn't it? I'm interested in your thoughts around this. I'm already a believer, but I'm not the expert. So tell me what your thoughts are about words and how important they are.
I'm not the expert either, but I'm convinced of their importance. And when we work with sort of professional development training for all sorts of health professionals, including psychs, we encourage people to be really, really precise, bearing in mind utility. And what we mean by that is every cue that the patient gets that they're, for example, their back, let's say we're talking about back pain, we could be talking about anything, pelvic, fibro, whatever. Any cue they get that their back is vulnerable will increase their protective setting and therefore will probably just nudge up pain just a little tiny bit. So be aware that the words you say and the way you say them will be algesic or analgesic. Or maybe benign.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, I can give you lots. The most obvious ones are diagnostic metaphors that are dangerous, like slip disc. You cannot slip a disc. The disc is completely unslippable. So we did work asking people who'd been given that diagnosis, what does that mean to you? If you had to explain that to someone who had no idea about anything, what would you say? And some of the metaphors that were fed back to us were catastrophic. For example, when you get a watermelon seed and you squeeze and it pops out? It's a bit like that. And then the next question is, so what happens when it pops out? Oh, the seed goes flying. And so if that was your disc, what happens? It goes through your spinal cord.
Right.
Like that is catastrophic. Or a bit of soap, a cake of soap, like a slippery cake of soap. So if you, the disc is like a cake of soap between two bits of wood. So if you bend over too far, it slips out the back straight into your spinal cord. What happens then? I guess I'd end up in a wheelchair.
Yeah, so there's that visualization there.
Yeah.
The imagery around that. People just, it fuels the fear, doesn't it? Is that right?
Absolutely. But what it simultaneously fuels, in my view, is the protection.
Yeah.
Okay. And we use the movement system protector. So they lock up. So they just stop bending. They just start making their back a rigid unit. And they start making more pain. And they also start making more pro-inflammatory cytokines. And they make a bit more cortisol. And, all this protective stuff. And the neuroscientist in me, so a chunk of my work is more fundamental neuroscience. And when we look at what helps neural networks function, precision is a big determinant. And the precision of a neural network, if it's about the body, will be enhanced by vision. So I ask patients, what do you reckon your ankle looks like? And if they're able to say, well, I've got this screw that's pushing out of the bone into the other side of the bone, that tells me they've got a pretty precise visual image of what their ankle's like. Which will be, they can't have that visual image unless it's held by the brain. Like it's neural networks that hold that visual image. And those neural networks connect immediately with protection of the ankle, for example. Anyway, the examples of that, the surgeons do it all the time. Oh, it was a mess in there, but I think I've managed to clean it up. You got the back of a 75-year-old.
Yeah.
Heel spurs.
Yeah.
Frozen shoulders, whiplash. All these things are catastrophic words.
Catastrophic. And, you know, you can, that can be set up, lived experience again, but you can be set up for years of pain with lazy language. You talk about precision. Yeah, and I agree with you. If psychologically, I think it's about hope and positivity. Like there are ways of communicating problems or, you know, even catastrophic injuries that imbue hope in a client. And then there are ways that lead to hopelessness, giving up, more, as you've said, more pain, more cortisol, et cetera. And I, in my experience, would say that there are chalk and cheese between, you know, clinicians as to how we, and I'm talking about not just psychologists, but, you know, physios, osteos, chiros, et cetera, how they provide that information, you know, how they talk about an injury and which, I don't know, just puts clients on a trajectory that's either, as I said, I feel quite passionate about it because it leads a lot needless suffering. Yeah, and what it means for psychologists at the other end of it is, what has the doctor said? Like you said, what has the doctor said about this? And you go, oh, here we go. Well, what hope am I going to have? I'm just the psychologist. Mm. What would I know? You're thinking that. What would you know? I've got this wonderful specialist or this fabulous physio or whatever. But I've got this patient who's not only in pain but now depressed or suicidal because I can't cope with the pain anymore.
Yeah, well, I've been known many times to ring a surgeon with the client in my office.
Yeah.
And say, hi, Andrew. This is the last one I rang. Hi, Andrew. I've got so-and-so here. So-and-so is quite concerned about what you said about the nerve being pinched. I'm wondering if you would be able to explain to her that the nerve cannot be pinched. It's an impossible event, but it's a way of talking. And maybe tell her what you actually mean about irritation from chemicals that can be flushed out and the problem resolved. Would you be happy to do that? She's on speaker now.
Beautiful.
And we use these metaphors really lazily. I think it was beautiful how you described it. Like there is, as lazy, we can set people up. But there are experiments on this. I was advisor to an experiment when I was living in the UK where laser stimuli were delivered to the foot of healthy volunteers while they were in a brain scanner. And the outcomes were how much does that laser stimulus hurt, and then I looked at brain activation. And there were two points on everyone's foot that were randomly allocated to be told at that point, this area of skin is a little bit thinner. The stimulus is probably safe, right? That was the phrasing. Or at the other side, this skin is normal. The stimulus is completely safe. So the only difference between these two groups was probably language or completely. That was it.
Yeah, right.
It was the only difference. And then they looked at how much it hurt. Now, it hurt more, so it was more pain when it was at the probably safe side. And there was differentiatable brain activation.
Yes.
Entirely on one word language being different. Wow. And there's a lot of examples like that. We've done experiments with blue light, pairing a blue light with a very cold stimulus or a red light. Red light hurts more. There's a lot of stuff like that. The one that I wonder if this would be relevant to your listeners that often surprises really, really experienced health professionals. Mm-hmm. In our attempts to be empathic and validate people, we often use a phrase that goes something like, I know your pain's very real for you. And what people understood when they said that was that the next sentence would be, but it's not real for me.
Yeah, I'm bristling at the thought of that. You said that to me.
Yeah. A lot of people will.
Yeah, you've lost me immediately.
Yeah, exactly. And you will give me the fuck off posture. Physios and doctors, that we like to validate the injury as a way of validating the experience, which is a real mistake too. You know, we tend to say, oh, no wonder it's hurting. It's mangled up in there. You know, all the alarms go, whir, whir, whir. It's mangled up. So, you know, we try and help physios and doctors to say, validate the experience. And it's hard for us to do that because we're not used to it, you know, but it's not, you know, this is clearly very painful. Like, that's not a hard thing to say. But as a physical therapist, you want to be able to say, because you've got a rupture.
Blah, blah, blah. You want to give tutorial, don't you?
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
You know, I don't think I said that to a specialist the other week. I said, are you going to give this patient a tutorial? Because I don't think she really needs one. She just wants to understand why she's still hurting when she's taken a lot of medication a huge lot of medication, which still isn't working. So, can we simplify that, please, for her? So, anyway, a take-home message for our listeners, what would it be around thinking psychologists who have it's stacked against them with pain, I think, a little bit because often patients, clients don't want to be here because they immediately come in with the arms crossed thinking we're going to tell them it's all in your head.
I mean, this is not a take-home message at all, but I think it is. I often say to GPs and physios that the effectiveness of psychologists is probably up to us because we need to sell them the right way. So whenever I speak to a patient where I think a psychologist would be helpful, I might say, do you think you'd be interested in learning skills from an expert in how you can modify some of those things?
Yeah.
That sort of phrase. I don't even say psychologist initially. Until I say, yeah, I would. Oh, well, I know some people they're so good at teaching you some ways to identify, understand, and just slowly change your system over time.
That sounds fantastic, yeah.
What's that? Psychologists could help us by, help the rest of the healthcare network by just coaching us on how to talk about you in a way that will de-threaten you. I think a lot of patients are really threatened by the idea of going to a psychologist for their knee pain or their neck pain or their endo or whatever it is. But the take-home message, if I was to feed that back, and your crowd might not be like this, but my experience among psychologists is that when they get over that same hump that we all have to get over of pain is not a thing outside of consciousness. It's not represented anywhere in the nervous system or the immune system. It really reflects the organism's attempt at protection. Mm-hmm. And once we really get that inside us, and once psychologists get that inside them, I think it liberates. The more you understand about how pain actually works, the more your expertise will make sense to you, I reckon. Mm-hmm. And that might be a bit of a mind bender. No, the more you understand, the more the psychologist understands about how pain works from a biological, neurophysiological perspective, the more your strategies will make sense to you.
So education. So I was thinking about before in that example you gave about ringing the doctor in on the spot. What if Professor Mosley calls you, wants to talk to you about what you said to your pain patient, you're going to sit up and listen, aren't you? But with Lisa Chantler, of course, they go, well, who the hell is she? No one cares about her. It's going to be a little harder. And I don't have the biological understanding.
Maybe the take-home message is learn. Get out there and learn stuff and don't presume that because you're a psychologist you understand all this stuff already.
Yeah.
And I'd say exactly the same to a physio, or a doctor. Don't presume that because you understand it. Like, they're not teaching this stuff accurately in universities as a rule just yet.
Okay, that's a worry, isn't it?
So most of us have a while ago since we're at uni. So,
but it hasn't changed. Or when health psychology programs are getting more up to date information.
Maybe, but I don't know. But I'd be so surprised if a health psychologist learns about neural networks and how they modify each other and why that's critical for understanding pain and fear and anxiety and PTSD and the need to we and all these feelings that protect us.
Well, if there are any health psychologists listening, you might, recently trained ones especially, if you might chip into the podcast, email us or Facebook, then we'll be very interested to hear. All right. Thank you so much, Lorimer, for your time.
Thank you. That was fun. It was great. Great chat. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, listeners, and I hope you've enjoyed the show. If you have, please remember to give us a 5-star review on your favourite platform. Also, you'll note that on the Facebook group, we'll post some of the links to some of the things that Laura and I have spoken about for your education and enjoyment. Until next time, it's bye from me.